Hey, everybody, and welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Mason Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I am Steve Saipa, and we'll be hearing from Lucas Vlahos, Ken Levin, and Thomas Henderson in just a little bit. But before we get to anything, obviously, Happy New Year's. And here's hoping that 2023 is prosperous and healthy and all that other good stuff for all of our listeners and ourselves, obviously. So our top prospect list for 2023, it's starting right now as we speak. Today is Monday, January 2nd, and the very first player on that list, number 25, William Lugo, his profile was posted today, and we'll be counting down from there over the next couple of weeks. This week, we are all going to be discussing our individual sleeper prospects, the players who we were highest on our individual lists who didn't make the collective list. Now, in the past, we discussed guys that just missed making it onto our top 25 lists as our sleeper prospects, but I think doing it like this, guys who actually did make it onto those lists but didn't make the collective top 25, I think that's a better indicator of who we are individually high on and, you know, who we think are going to be up-and-coming players. That's probably a better definition of sleeper. So for me, that guy is right-handed pitcher Jonah Tong. The Mets selected him with their seventh-round pick in the 2022 MLB draft last year. He was the 209th player selected overall. His full name, Jonah Reed Tin Chi Matthew Tong. He is an Ontario, Canada native. He attended Bill Crothers Secondary School in Markham, which is a city about 30 miles from Toronto. And then he transferred to Georgia Premier Academy in Statesboro, Georgia, for his senior year last year. That's one of those weird sports schools that, you know, gets its accreditation from a third party, but it mainly is like focusing on it's a sports boarding school, one of those kinds of things, basically. So after graduating, or basically right at the end of his senior year last year, right before graduating, he also pitched for the Frederick Keys. And the Keys are a former Baltimore Orioles High A affiliate. They got cut loose after the minor league realignment of 2021, and they became one of the MLB Draft League teams. So he made four appearances with them, three starts, and he posted a 1080 ERA in 11.2 innings, allowing 14 hits, walking 10, and striking out 14. So not all that impressive, but it is important to keep in mind that he was one of about a dozen teenagers who played in that league last season. He was a bit younger than the league average, because the league average is basically a bunch of secondary level college players who are in the league to kind of get attention on them prior to either going back to college or prior to the draft. So when the Mets drafted Tong, he needed to decide between either going pro, obviously, or going to North Dakota State University, where he had a commitment to. And if he went there, he would be eligible to get drafted again in 2024. And he weighed the pros and the cons. And basically, he decided that taking the deal with the Mets would basically be in his best interests for his career and, you know, related, obviously, financially. And he signed for the exact slot value for his pick, which was $225,800. Mets technically signed him to the Florida Complex League Mets last season, but he didn't actually pitch. He was actually the only prep pitcher that the Mets drafted last season, so we don't have any other guys to compare him to. But if we take a look back a little further down and look at the 2021 draft, the Mets only drafted one prep pitcher, one prep player, period, actually, and they kept him out the entire season too. So it seems like that's currently the organizational imperative right now. Prep pitchers don't pitch immediately. And that other prep pitcher was Calvin Ziegler, by the way, and he will be referenced a little bit in the next few minutes. But Jonah Tong, so what do the Mets see in him to make him their seventh round pick? And what do I see him see in him that, you know, makes me think he's a sleeper. He's got a classic projectionable frame, 6'1", 180 pounds. He pushes off the mound well. He gets good extension. There is some effort in his delivery, and that does impact his command and control. But at the present, I wouldn't say that effort is like a major catastrophic, unfixable red flag or anything like that. I was looking at video of him pitching with the keys, and I know it sounds weird to say this, that his mechanics remind me of someone who basically has one of the most unorthodox and unrepeatable mechanics over the last, like, decade or two. But Jonah Tong's delivery reminds me a lot of Tim Lincecum, and I would definitely recommend any of the listeners right now to, you know, cue up some of the video of Tong pitching and cue up some video of Lincecum pitching, because they both have some big leg kicks, a little bit of a twist, long arm action through the back, really great push off the mound, and obviously with Tim Lincecum especially, insane extension off of it, and a relatively low release point relative to throwing from a high three-quarter slot because of the drop and drive off the mound. Obviously, I'm not saying that Jonah Tong is going to become Tim Lincecum. You know, if Tong could have a quarter of the career that Lincecum had, that would be awesome, because a quarter of Tim Lincecum's career is basically like one All-Star game, one top 10 Cy Young finish. You know, if Jonah Tong could have one All-Star game and one top 10 Cy Young career, that would be a pretty awesome career. Great outcome from that, from his pick. But back to Tong. His fastball sits low to mid-90s. You could definitely see that improving in a couple of years as he ages and he grows and he gets stronger. The pitch has a high spin rate, and then combine that with the flat vertical approach angle that it has from his release point, it's very effective up in the zone. Complements it with a curveball and a changeup, the former of which is really good, and the latter, not so much right now. Curveball sits in the high 70s, big 12-6 movement. Since he pitched in the MLB Draft League, we have some StatCast data, and his curveball has been measured as high as 2,800 RPM. Now, the Major League average for a curveball last year was basically 2,500, so it is flashing above average spin, and that's good. It gives it power drop. Issue with that is he telegraphs the pitch actually noticeably sometimes. He brings his arm up a lot, and he throws it at a much higher slot and release point. But, you know, he is, you know, 18/19. Doesn't have any professional coaching, and that's something that very easily could be worked on with professional coaches. You know, there are guys that still have that kind of issue after going professional, so I'm not going to say that that's something that can be eliminated entirely, but definitely something that could be worked on. His changeup, something that needs to be worked on. It sits in the low 80s, still pretty firm right now, but it does flash potential. In the draft league, it had a high swing and miss rate. And again, it wasn't against prep hitters who are nowhere on his level. It had a high swing and miss rate against college-aged hitters, most of whom are older than him. So you definitely could see that pitch coming along and turning into, you know, maybe an average or better pitch with some professional coaching. So I mentioned Calvin Ziegler before, and there are definitely some parallels between him and Jonah Tong. Obviously, they are both Canadians, so that impacted their travel ball and their high school baseball opportunities. And they both moved to the U.S. in their final high school years to basically maximize their draft potential. Both have similar fastballs in terms of velocity bands and approach angle. Changeups are both equally raw with potential. I guess Ziegler's is a little more advanced right now just by virtue of him having a year of professional coaching and everything under his belt, whereas Tong does not. Biggest difference between the two of them is their curveball. They both have curveballs, obviously, but they are really fundamentally different pitches. Ziegler's curveball, it has a really low spin rate, which is actually, you know, reading up about low spin rate curves, it's pretty interesting. But his curveball, it averaged 2,170 RPM last season. So that gives it basically big loopy break. And in addition, you know, to getting the swings and misses on that, it also induces a lot of weak fly balls. If you look at his Fangraphs page, Ziegler, look at his infield fly ball rate, it is very high. So definitely doing what needs to be done. Tong's curveball, on the other hand, like I said, it has above average spin rates, topping out at 2,800 RPM. Those kinds of curveballs have power break that get tons of ground balls. So I see a lot of potential in Tong. I had him ranked 17 overall on my list. He was basically all of the guys in the mid to late teens are a bunch of raw but talented teenagers down the low levels of the minor leagues. So, you know, Tong is definitely a high variance, high risk player. Definitely a bunch of different ways that things go in the next calendar year. He could have a good season. And if he does, maybe he enters closer to the top 10. Maybe he even sneaks into the top 10 if there's a bunch of graduations from the system and or trades next season. If he has a bad year, I could see him dropping off the list entirely. Maybe forever. Who knows? Or if he recovers just for next season's prospect list. But, you know, that is the perils of young, talented, but high variance guys like this. You know, at this point, their careers can go in a lot of different ways. Giving him a little edge also, he is on the record saying that Revenge of the Sith is his favorite Star Wars movie. So clearly he is a fellow man of culture as well. So yeah, Jonah Tong, I think that he is a sleeper, and he is definitely a guy to keep an eye on. Lucas is not here this week. He's not available. He has some very important school stuff that he needs to finish, and we all wish him good luck with that. So his sleeper was Zach Green, who the Mets just acquired a couple of weeks ago in the Rule 5 draft. Green has had a kind of convoluted path to professional baseball. After graduating high school, first he went to UNC Asheville. He didn't pitch there too much, and he really wasn't that great either when he did pitch. So he transferred for his sophomore year to St. John's River State College in Palatka, Florida, which is about 50 miles from Jacksonville, which is where he's from. And he was basically a big fish in a small pond there. And he posted a very good ERA, 0.92 ERA in 29.1 innings, over 25 relief appearances with 23 hits allowed, 15 walks, and 46 strikeouts. His performance did not get him drafted by a team in the 2016 draft, but it did get him recruited by a new D1 team. So he transferred to the University of South Alabama for his junior season, and he was pretty good. He posted a 3.79 ERA in 57 innings, over 23 appearances, with 53 hits, 13 walks, and 80 strikeouts. He did get drafted by a major league team, the Marlins. They drafted him in the 15th round of the 2018 draft, but he turned them down, and he went back to school for his senior year. And he had another good season with the Jaguars. He posted a 1.45 ERA in 49.2 innings over 27 appearances, with 35 hits allowed, 8 walks, and 70 strikeouts. And that led him getting selected by the Yankees in the 8th round of the 2019 draft. But as a senior, you know, he had no leverage, so he signed for just $17,500. He pitched for the GCL Yankees and the Staten Island Yankees that summer. He's pretty good. Then obviously missed 2020 because of COVID. And then in 2021, he pitched for the Hudson Valley Renegades and the Somerset Patriots, the Yankees high A and double A affiliates. And he posted between those two teams a combined 3.17 ERA in 59.2 innings over 34 appearances with 39 hits, 21 walks, and 91 strikeouts. This past season, He pitched for the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Rail Riders, the Yankees' AAA affiliate, and he posted a 3.42 ERA in 68.1 innings, allowing 58 hits, walking 32, and striking out 96. And he was left off of their 40-man roster and was selected by the Mets in Rule 5 draft, like I said earlier. So on the surface, it would be easy to say that Green is kind of a flash in the pan, a product of the minor league environment. You know, his fastball, it sits like 90 to 93, and his changeup is still kind of developing pitch. So he's mainly a two-pitch pitcher, a fastball slider guy, and he gives up a lot of hard contact. So, you know, is that the kind of pitcher that's going to survive on a major league roster? If you look deeper, if you look under the surface stats and look into some of the analytical things, okay, it gets a little better. You'll see that his fastball has a really high spin rate. It's been measured as high as 2,500 RPM. And it also has a low vertical approach angle because he drops off the mound and drives with a lot of extension. He has a very low release point. So those are two things working in his favor in regards to the fastball. And his slider, it has that sweepy break that a lot of recent research has demonstrated, has shown that, you know, it's very effective lately, and he gets a lot of outs with it, either via strikeout or just via weak contact. So Lucas thinks that those pitch characteristics that Green has give him a decent chance to have some MLB success in some capacity. You know, that modicum of success that he's had in the upper minors with Somerset and Scranton, he has had about 100 innings or so in total with a roughly a 3.50 ERA, 3.5 walks per nine. That's kind of eh, but 13 strikeouts per nine, that's pretty great. The jump now to the majors, this is his last test, and, you know, obviously it's not a one-for-one transaction. You know, success in AA, success in AAA does not equal success in the major leagues. Otherwise, there'd be a lot more major leaguers out there. But there's a track record of success in the upper minors, and, you know, that bodes well, hopefully, for his future as a major leaguer. You'd rather see the success in AA and AAA than not having any success at all. Ken is not available either this week. He's got some family in town, and we all know how that goes. But his sleeper pick was Junior Tillian. Junior, he has been in the system for a couple of years now. He was signed during the 2019 to 2020 international free agent signing period. He signed for $185,000, which was a little less than what scouts thought he would get at first. You know, professional teams always have leverage and power over these kids, these families from the Caribbean. You know, they're invariably, usually, not always, but usually poor. So, you know, the teams always have the power and leverage. And basically every deal is a bargain for the team when you think about it. You know, even a guy that makes the major leagues in the most minimal capacity possible and is just barely a replacement player, he's still providing positive value, and the team getting positive value out of a player who signed for a couple of $1,000s. You know, that's a win for the team. But Tillian, you know, his deal is a bargain, and in his case specifically, it might be an even bigger bargain because he has looked a lot better basically when the Mets scouts, you know, finally had him in Mets camp and were able to give him a better look. His hit tool looked a lot better than it had earlier when he was still a quote unquote free agent, you know, because we all know how these deals in the IFA market go. But That might have been why they were very aggressive with him, because obviously, you know, he didn't play in 2019 because he was just too young, and then obviously he missed 2020 because of COVID. So his first assignment came in 2021, and the Mets were aggressive with him. They decided to send him to the complex and skip him over the DSL completely, and, you know, the faith in him might have been real and expectations high, whatever, but he did struggle. Tillian hit 165, 223, 233 in 32 games. No homers, no stolen bases, and 6 walks to 24 strikeouts. He didn't let that struggle bring him down. As we spoke about a little bit last year, in the case of Adrian Hernandez, who struggled, and those struggles seemed to cause him to spiral, I guess is the best way of saying it. I mean, look at his career now. It's basically over. Obviously, I think there might have been more to it than that. But point is, those struggles did not basically make him down and out. He was impressive during spring training this past season, and the Mets elected to send him to St. Lucie. Now, you know, a young guy like that being sent to St. Lucie, worst case scenario, he struggles again. And then when the FCL team starts in June, the team sends him to the FCL complex. So whatever, no big deal. Tillian, he did not struggle. In his first 2 months at the St. Lucie Mets, he hit 260, 317, 466 with 7 homers, 2 stolen bases, and 11 walks to 29 strikeouts. So that is really good. And the home runs came in bunches. He did have a 1-3 home run game, which is impressive no matter what level you're playing at. Junior did slow down in the second half. He hit 245, 311, 370 with 5 home runs, 1 stolen base, and 19 walks to 53 strikeouts. But all in all, it was a very good year. He hit a cumulative 248, 312, 406 in 84 games with 12 home runs, 3 stolen bases, and 30 walks to 81 strikeouts. He was a slightly above average offensive player in the St. Lucie Mets lineup, and was one of only 4 Mets players in the system who got double-digit home runs and were 20 years of age or younger, along with William Lugo, Francisco Alvarez, and Alexander Ramirez. Tillian, he only has average bat speed, but he does have strong wrists, and he does have good hand-eye coordination, so he does make a lot of contact, and he puts the ball in play. And, you know, when you put the ball in play, especially in the minor leagues, anything could happen. He averaged 85.7 miles per hour exit velocity on all the balls that he hit. All the balls that he put in play last year. 31 of those had exit velocities of 100 or higher, and 5 had exit velocities of 105 or higher. He logged 52 singles. They averaged 87.5 miles an hour. He had 13 doubles. They averaged 97.2. He had 1 triple. That averaged 96.4. And his 12 home runs averaged exactly 100 miles an hour. He is tall, and he's lanky. He's listed 6'1", 170 pounds, and he definitely looks at 170 pounds. So he should continue adding muscle mass and power, and, you know, hopefully those home run numbers grow. Now, before he signed with the Mets officially, scouting services and evaluators that saw him, they kind of figured he was going to be a third baseman or might even be an outfielder. But the Mets, I don't want to say were stubborn and stupid. That's not the right word. But they had faith. That's a much nicer way of putting it. And they were higher on Junior's defensive abilities. And so far, surprisingly, given some of the Mets' track record, especially the pre-Cohen days when their scouting and analytics departments were not as large as they are now, but surprisingly, they've got it right. They see him as a shortstop long-term, and the 2 years that he's been playing professionally, he's been mostly playing at short, and he really has not done anything to make people think that he won't be able to stay there. His speed is about average. He has an above-average arm, so, you know, he does have the range and the arm to play at shortstop. And if he fills in, yeah, he might have to move off the position. But, you know, big shortstops do exist. I mean, move up a couple of levels and you'll see Ronnie Mauricio, who is a big shortstop. So, you know, even if Tillian does fill in, you know, it's not a guarantee that he is going to have to move off shortstop. So a guy with, at least in lower minors so far, the ability to put the ball in play and hit for a lot of power at shortstop it's a good combination. And Ken likes him because he was roughly a league average hitter, you know, a little bit better, despite being 2 years younger than the average for the level. He showed a bit of pop. He had a 158 ISO. He showed a decent walk rate. He had a 8.5% walk percentage. And if he could eliminate a couple of the strikeouts and make a little bit more contact, you know, the Mets could have another high-ish upside international success. And it's not really too outlandish to think that that's not something he can improve. You know, given how young and inexperienced he is, next season is gonna be a big test in that regard, because he's gonna start seeing now a lot more former college pitchers who have decent breaking balls. And you know, I could see him struggle because he's never been exposed to that kind of stuff. But at the same time, as raw as he is, you know, he didn't dominate Florida State League pitching, but he did hold his own and then some. So, you know, why not? Why can't the same thing happen in the South Atlantic League when he's another year older and wiser and has some more baseball experience underneath his belt? And finally now, last but not least, Thomas. And Thomas is not available for this episode as well, but he was high on Christian Scott. And Scott is from Coconut Creek, which is a great name. I really have to say, it's a great name for a town in Florida. And apparently also it's the butterfly capital of the world, which is kind of cool, I guess. The world's largest butterfly aviary is there. It has 80 different species of butterflies and about 20,000 individual butterflies in captivity there. So that actually sounds like a cool place to visit. If I'm ever in Florida and I happen to find myself in Coconut Creek, I would definitely visit the butterfly aviary. But anyway, Christian Scott, he attended Calvary Christian High School. He graduated in 2018, and he went to the University of Florida. Very typical Florida man. His freshman year there, he led the team in appearances. He made 22 appearances. He started 4 games, and he pitched out of the bullpen in 18. And he posted a 5.19 ERA in exactly 52 innings, allowing 54 hits, walking 18, and striking at 44. He was a lot better as a reliever than he was as a starter. Basically, he halved his ERA. So in 2020, he was used exclusively out of the bullpen, and his 2020 season started off well in Florida, in February and early March, but, you know, 2020 happened, so he was eligible to be drafted in that draft, but because of his age, but since the draft was so short and abbreviated, he wasn't selected, so he went back to University of Florida for his junior season. And he appeared in 26 games that year. He made one start, and the rest were out of the bullpen. And he posted an even 3 ERA in 54 innings, allowing 46 hits, walking 9, and striking at 51. And the Mets liked what they saw. And in the 2021 draft, they selected him with their 5th-round selection, and they signed him for $350,000. He made a handful of appearances with the FCL Mets that summer, but basically his professional career started this year in earnest. Along with all those other college pitchers that the Mets drafted in the middle rounds of the 2021 draft, Scott started in St. Lucie. He was used intermittently as a starter and a reliever. He pitched a total of 37 innings in St. Lucie, over 12 games total, so 4 starts and 8 relief appearances. And he posted a 4.82 ERA with 40 hits allowed, 12 walks, and 52 strikeouts. He was promoted to Brooklyn in mid-August. He finished the season there, and he posted a 3.80 ERA in 21.1 innings over 5 starts and 1 relief outing, with 21 hits allowed, 10 walks, and 25 strikeouts. So, all in all, in his first professional season, low A and high A, he posted a 4.45 ERA in 58.2 innings, with 61 hits allowed, 22 walks, and 77 strikeouts. Scott has a presence on the mound. He's 6'4", 215. He definitely could be a starter if that's what they want him to be. He has the physicality for it. He throws from a three-quarter arm slot, but there is some effort. His landing is a little stiff. There's a head whack. There's some effort in his arm. And he'll have, because of that, he'll have spurts with the command. Looks fine. And then he'll have spurts where, you know, he's walking like two guys in three innings, four guys in five innings, that kind of thing. He's mainly a two-pitch pitcher. He's mainly a sinker-slider guy. Occasionally, he throws a four-seam fastball, a cutter, a changeup, but really, none of those are used much, if at all. His sinker, it ranges 92 to 96. It averages 94 miles an hour. It has a lot of movement, and it's hard for hitters to square up on and make good contact, but it doesn't really get too many whiffs. Optimally, he would get more ground balls with it, but he gets a lot of weak infield fly balls instead. And, I mean, I guess it's six of one thing, half dozen of another, because for every ground ball that a player hits that you say, okay, well, ground ball is more likely to be an out, you know, something's going to get past the fielder. For every weak infield fly ball that a guy hits, you're like, okay, well, it's an infield fly ball, whatever, it's an out, you know. There's always, you know, hitting it where they ain't and dying quails and all that stuff. So I guess, you know, it really doesn't make too much of a difference. His slider, that is where he gets the strikeouts. It's 82 to 85, averaging 83, and it tunnels very well with his fastball. It has a sharp late two-plane bite, anywhere between 1 to 7 inches of horizontal movement and 36 to 43 inches of vertical drop. And he mainly throws it to his glove side. He'll get right-handers to chase down and away with it. He does also use it occasionally against left-handers, though, back-footing it against them. Against left-handers, that's mainly where his changeup comes in. It's still a developing pitch. He really doesn't use it much. You know, he's mainly a 50-50 fastball slider guy. But when he does use the changeup, it is against left-handers to just basically keep him honest and get him chasing. It sits 82 to 84, but it's pretty firm. There's not a lot of tumble to it. It does tunnel well with his two-seamer, and he does keep his arm speed. He maintains his arm speed pretty well. So there's definitely potential for him to develop it more if they choose to go in that direction where he's going to need a third pitch. And that is what makes him kind of interesting. I don't know what Thomas specifically likes about Scott, but from my point of view, there's a lot of ways that his career can go. He has the body to be a starter. He has the repertoire to be a starter. He just needs to improve that changeup, definitely. And maybe, you know, mix in more, maybe a more well-defined cutter or maybe a couple of more well-defined curveballs in addition to the slider. But there's definitely a potential to be a starting pitcher. He also has experience pitching out of the bullpen, and his two-pitch mix already has demonstrated against college pitchers and minor leaguers in low A and high A that it could work. So presumably we'll see him in Binghamton next year. So not only will his stuff get that, you know, double A is a good enough test, but I guess we'll see what kind of role the Mets are interested in going forward with him in. All right, well, that was a mouthful. So if anyone has any questions, comments, or whatever, you can send us an email at fromcomplexthequeens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at lvlahost343. Ken is at kenlevin91. And Thomas is at sadmetsseason, SZN. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Rate and review it. And of course, we thank you for listening. And we will be back next week. So until then, I'm going to go have a very nice cold glass of water. And love the Mets. Love the Mets.